This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking with a friend of mine, Will Williams. We'll be talking about the Vietnam War, Iraq, Afghanistan. And Will Williams, I've known for several years as a fellow peace activist. He's an activist with Veterans for Peace. There's actually a chapter on Will Williams in a great book called Long Shadow, Veterans' Paths to Peace, which has since been made into a documentary by the same name. Will Williams, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I just reread that chapter in Long Shadow that you wrote, your own account of going to war in Vietnam. But at the beginning, you write about growing up in Mississippi. I'd like you to tell me a little bit about that, because one startling line is right there at the top of my head that you wrote, and it was, "I was young with a lot of hate."
Yes, well, I was born September 11, 1943, in Crystal Springs, Mississippi, a small town about 30 miles south of Jackson. And during those times, the Jim Crow laws were very much used in the South. So I grew up seeing people of color being beaten and killed for no reason other than who they were. My grandmother was Seminole, so she had told me some of the things that had happened to her people. And I just started hating people and wondering why. And it led even to a greater problem for me when I got in school and started learning about the Constitution, how this country was founded. And I never could square the Declaration of Independence with what was happening. I questioned why, if we're created equal, why is this happening? So I just started getting mean and hateful. And it was my grandmother who first told me that if I did not learn to control the hate and anger that I had, it would destroy me from within. And I didn't know what that meant until about 50 years later.
You write that you couldn't have marched with Martin Luther King in the 60s. Why?
No, because I did not understand his philosophy, and I couldn't see turning the other cheek. If someone hit me, I would hit back. So I couldn't have marched with him, neither do I believe he would have allowed me to.
So why did you decide to join the military?
I came from a single-parent family. It was nine of us in the family. And I was tired of Mississippi. I knew that had I stayed there, I probably would have been lynched because I wouldn't have taken the abuse that was being used on people, especially black males during that time. And I felt it was better for me to get out of that state. And another thing, I thought it would help me send money back to help my mother. So it was a double thing. That the reason I left is because of the hate I had that I felt would cause my demise, and I wanted to help my mother. So the military was a way out.
And what what did you find in the military? What was the level of racism in the military?
When I first went in July of 1962, my boot camp was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and I saw racism there. The difference in treatment. It was pervasive throughout my military career. My first tour of duty was in Germany, where I didn't see racism from the people, the German people, but when we would go to the bars or the guest houses, I saw it from the GIs that were there from the South. So it followed me throughout the military. In Vietnam, it was the same. In 1969 at Cameron Bay, it was a race riot because of differences in treatment of people of color as far as job descriptions were.
And when did you yourself get to Vietnam?
My first tour, I got there on about the 18th of January, 1966.
And what was that experience like?
horrific. The first 2 weeks, it wasn't bad. We were in an area where we were within a perimeter for orientation, where we got used to the sounds of battle and the climate. After that, we went to Kuchi, which was my base for the remainder of my tour. And there, it was death and destruction from one day to another. We were either getting sniped on within the perimeter because the base camp was right above tunnels, or we were going out doing search and destroy missions where we would get ambushed and get beaten up pretty bad.
At what point did it dawn on you that this thing was pretty messed up?
I felt within a few months there that we couldn't, that it was no win in Vietnam.
Was that a commonly held belief among the soldiers?
Yes, I think overall most did feel that we couldn't win because of the type fighting we were doing. We would go in and clear an area, then leave it, and a few weeks later we'll come back in the same area and meet the same resistance we had before. And you couldn't distinguish the so-called enemy from the people, because in the Mekong, I was fighting against Viet Cong, a guerrilla warfare, where the troops up north of Pleiku were fighting North Vietnamese Army, which had uniforms and you could identify.
You write that you were better off that you went to Vietnam, or that Vietnam made you. What did you mean by that?
That with the hate that I had leaving Mississippi, I feel that by going to Vietnam and experiencing the death, the hate that I carried from Mississippi to Vietnam for people that I knew nothing about, I think those experiences, along with the nightmares, the flashbacks, made me love people more. It made me realize more that we are all connected, and to have a respect for people in general more than I did when I was growing up in Mississippi.
I'm speaking with Will Williams, an activist with Veterans for Peace. He is in a book called Long Shadow, Veterans Paths to Peace. He wrote his own account there. And that book has since been made into a documentary by the same name. And I've heard Will Williams speak very powerfully at anti-war rallies. And you mentioned in some of those that you've had those nightmares and flashbacks. Do you still get them?
Yes, I still do. I still go to VA and get treatment for it, but
is there one persistent one that you get?
Yes, one is a memory of a friend that was real close. We used to sing together, doo-wop together, and he was killed on a patrol, and we had to sit in a bomb crater all night with him. That one keep coming back.
Now, you wrote in that chapter that you actually wanted to go back to Vietnam for another tour because you were so angry at the anti-war protesters. Explain that.
Yes. In 1967, my wife and I were visiting her aunt and uncle in San Francisco, and I wandered down to the Haight-Ashbury district in uniform, not knowing about the district at all or the people there. And it was a protest going on, a protest that I didn't understand, didn't know what it was about. And even though the people weren't directing their anger or frustrations at me, it teed me off. It made me angry that they was doing it. Not that I felt they were unpatriotic. I just was angry. And I think part of it was because I had been back in country from combat not a long time and not understanding the message that they were putting out made me angry. And I felt it would have been easy for me to take one out or kill or hurt someone at the protests, even though they never spat on me, as many people say they did. I felt the best thing for me to do was to go back to Vietnam, where it was legal to vent my frustrations and anger.
Is that what you did, then?
That's what I did. I put in what is called a 1049, which is a request to go back to Vietnam.
And what was the experience like when you got back there?
Well, before I got back, they didn't allow me to go back immediately because I hadn't been in the country long enough. So I was transferred from Fort Carson to the Canal Zone to Panama, where I learned of the School of Americas. And while I was in Panama, I got the orders to go back to Vietnam. The second tour was totally different. This time I was not in an infantry unit. I was attached to an MP unit at Cameron Bay, which was a logistical site for supplies for the whole Three Corps. And it was not much any fighting that we did. The ROC soldiers, Korean soldiers, had the perimeter set up, so we were within a perimeter for quite a while. So the experience was totally different.
And were you there when there was that race riot?
Yes.
And how did that start?
It happened because, part of it, I think, was because of the difference in duties that people of color were getting. Many times when people got wounded and they would come back to the rear, go to another outfit, they would go to a job where they wouldn't be going back out in a hostile environment. But when they got these other jobs, it was the worst jobs in the unit, like humping ammo or something. And even though your specialty or your job description was different, you ended up getting these jobs. So many of the people of color got angry because of it. If they were, say, a radar technician, they were working in the ammo dump, or a sanitation engineer, which was burning the feces, the waste. And I remember specifically it was a movie that played that Jim Brown was in. I think it was 100 Rifles, I think was the name of it. And it was a scene in it where I think Raquel Welch was at this water tower where they were putting water in the train, the old steam engines. And Jim Brown hugged her or tried to kiss her or something, and some racist words began from people watching the movie, and that's what happened.
And what happened during the riot exactly?
Well, since the African-Americans, most of them worked in the ammo dumps, and they had the weapons and the ammo, and I remember that they were set up on a hill, and like our unit where the hooch in a housing area were down in under the hill in the valley. And I remember my first sergeant asking, you know, we'll go up there and try to stop this. And I said, no, you know, I won't get involved in it because, number one, we can't go up there with force and stop this. I said, somebody need to talk to the people. And that's what happened. Eventually, we went and talked to both sides, and it quelled it.
No, I'm struck by the fact that you went back to Vietnam in part because you couldn't comprehend the anti-war protesters, and then you've become an anti-war protester yourself. Tell me about that transformation.
Well, I started feeling different about it. During my second tour, I started having second thoughts about Vietnam and about what we, and I say we as a country, were doing there. And when I came back at the end of that tour, it was around the time Daniel Ellsberg had begun leaking the Pentagon Papers. So I began reading everything I could about Vietnam, and even went farther and started reading more about America, this country that, you know, supposed to be the beacon on the hill for people to come and live. And I couldn't understand what was going on. And the more I read, the angrier I got. And when the full Pentagon papers were released and I saw, you know, the reasons why we went to Vietnam were basically a lie, the Tonkin Gulf incident of 1964 that never happened was one of the main reasons that I was in that build-up to go to Vietnam. It made me angry, anger with the country, with the system. So I started reading more and more, and it got to a point to where I couldn't communicate. I couldn't do anything. It was like I was possessed with anger. So I stopped reading. I stopped participating in anything that had to do with the military. So,
but you didn't join peace groups right away?
No. My main concern was my family, mm-hmm. my wife and my daughter at the time, and later the grandkids.
And I first met you, I think, right after 9/11, when there were peace protests here in Wisconsin. And I remember one rally you were at. We were in Wausau, Wisconsin on February 15th, and it was about 11 degrees up there, and you were speaking there. So at some point, you decided to hook up with the peace movement. How'd that happen?
Well, I was watching the news after September 11th. Well, I won't say news. I was watching the pundit spew this propaganda. And I remember one of the pundits said something about people would always remember September 11, 2001. This was the worst day in the history of the country. And I said, that's bull. I say it's not, because September 11 didn't strike me as it did maybe many other people because of what I had read and learned. I felt that this country had operated all around the world and had done things to people that eventually would come back to haunt them, and that September 11 was just the bursting of that bubble, that bubble that I think we, the American people, felt insulated us from the deeds that we did. You know, the oceans separated us from what we were doing to people. The other thing that bothered me was September 11. That's my birthday. I was born September 11, 1943. So when I kept hearing people say, that's a bad day, I said, no, it's not. That's the day I was born. And that's when stuff started hitting me so hard. My wife told me I should go and join something. And I went to see Tammy Baldwin in DeForest at a town hall meeting and met two people from Madison Area Peace Coalition, Bob Vith and Barazona. And they invited me to come to MAPC, and my wife harassed me until I did. So that's how I became involved.
And did you have an experience doing public speaking before? Because you're a very gifted public speaker.
No, I had never spoken before. I'd never even tried.
You'd sung before, though.
Yeah. I grew up singing gospel, old-time gospel. And when I first came to Madison, I met a man from Fayette, Mississippi, Deacon Julius Johnson, who got me started back singing, and eventually my wife and I started a group called the Madison Gospel Heirs.
I'm speaking with Will Williams. He's an activist with Vets for Peace. There's a chapter that he wrote in a great book called Long Shadow, Veterans' Paths to Peace, which is also a documentary with the same name. Will, where are we as a country right now? We've had this Iraq war that Bush dragged us into. We've got this Afghanistan war going on that Obama is escalating. Why is he doing that, first of all?
I think we're where we are. I think we're still dying that spiritual death that Dr. King spoke of, because this country still put things before people. We still, as a country, exploit people throughout the world for the benefit, I feel, of corporations and those at the top level. I feel that we have more enemies now since the Bush administration has been in, because of his abrasiveness to nations throughout the world. With Obama, I don't see the change that was promised, that people were expecting. Much of it is his fault, because I believe if he truly wanted to change this country, that he had the power to do it. I think since Dr. King, he was perhaps the most galvanizing voice that reached people of all races. And all he would have to do, say, for health care, if he wanted to pass it, is make a call for people to come to D.C. by the millions and occupy it. I think they would do it, because I think the country was in such disarray during the Bush administration that they were expecting hope and change from someone. And
well, why doesn't he make that call?
Because he's a politician. I think even though he started as a community leader, that, number one, he's a politician. I also feel that he may have been groomed in a lot of stuff. His ideas are not the same as Dr. King's were. Like I've often said, if you could switch the roles of Obama, if Dr. King was in now, it would be different. He would make that call, and this country would do the things that should be done to help people, not only here but throughout the world. But I don't think Obama will make that call, and I believe the president does not have the power to make these changes that he promised. You can look at what's happening in Congress now with the so-called Democrats that are against single payer, you know, which I feel is the only reform for health care that will work. I feel that as long as health care is administered by or controlled by the people that are in it, that we are in this problem, as long as it's for profit. Mm-hmm. You know,
now, you get your health care through the VA?
I go to VA, and I also have TRICARE.
Mm-hmm. And VA is socialized medicine, is actual government medicine.
Yes, it is.
How has your care been at the VA?
It's been good. I can't complain about it. At times, it seems slow, but I guess it is everywhere.
Now, given your experience in Vietnam, do you think that Afghanistan is going to be another Vietnam? Is it Obama's Vietnam? What's the risk there?
I think it's Obama's Vietnam, and I think in a sense it's worse than Vietnam, number one, because of the terrain. They can't maneuver the military equipment on those trails in the mountains as they did in Vietnam. I think we underestimated the people again, that this country goes blindly into areas not understanding the culture. The people there are fighting the same ways. They're not fighting uniform people. And it's no way. I think when people are fighting for a cause, they have more to fight for than those who are fighting because they were sent there by a government. And whether we like it or not, those people have a cause.
Will Williams, with Vets for Peace, how do you assess the state of the peace movement right now?
I think it's weak. I don't think it's as strong as it should be, and I think it's many things that probably causes that. I think the economy, number one, many people don't come out of fear of losing their jobs, or they can't afford to come out, or they're working two jobs just to survive. But I think the spirit is still there, that there are those who are dedicated that will continue to do it, and hopefully it will grow and people will get to the numbers that they need to bring a change. And it make me think of what the great Shawnee chief Tecumseh said, that a twig will break, but a bundle is strong. And I feel that we need to put these twigs and branches together and get a bundle, because this is a moment in history that I think people can bring the change that need it, if they'll only come together and do it.
You wrote in your chapter in Long Shadow, vets' paths to peace, that too many activists are looking for instant gratification, you know, success today. You know, this protest is going to stop the war now. And you've stressed the need for people to be in it for the long haul. Do you want to amplify that?
Yes. I think, well, early on, I noticed that people were against the war in Iraq, just saying bring the troops home from Iraq. And I was looking beyond that. What I saw was stopping war, period. Take away the things that create war, such as exploitation of people for either their resources or their labor. Take all those things away. Treat people just all over the world, and it will take away that need that this country seemed to have to spend billions of dollars on weapons of mass destruction rather than spending it on people's needs. So I think it's what's crippling this country is this idea. I feel that America has a war mentality, that war is glorified. If you'll notice, almost everything they get involved in, it's war. The war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on this, the war on that. And I think with that mentality, we'll forever be doing this unless people gravitate toward the one thing that can save the whole world, and that's peace and justice for all mankind because of the connections that we have with all people.
Will Williams, if you met someone as soon as this interview is over, a young man or a young woman who was not faring very well economically, or his or her family wasn't doing well economically, and they didn't know which way to go, and they were considering joining the Army or the Marines, what would you tell that person?
I wouldn't tell them not to, but I would tell them of different things, different ways that they can make it without going in the military. I would explain to them what the mission of the military is. And it is to kill. It's not to rebuild countries. But I would not say don't do it as I did with my grandkids. I would give them information that I hope would open up their minds to where they would not do it. But I feel that it's a decision that they must make. And I also explain to them that, you know, you have to think of the consequences. You have to ask yourself the question, number one, can you kill someone that have done nothing to you simply because your country or your commander say do it? Could you live with that? So that decision you have to make, you know, yourself. But
and did they join?
My grandson did, and he was only in for about 2 months before he realized he had messed up. And luckily, they broke his contract, and we were able to get him out. This was in 1999.
Well, you were lucky that way, but I think you gave him good advice. And it's too bad he didn't listen the first time. But unfortunately, we're out of time. My guest today has been Will Williams. And you can find out more about his story by reading Long Shadow, Veterans' Paths to Peace, or seeing the documentary by the same name, Long Shadow. Will Williams, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella, an engineer at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.